When it comes to the illegal act of detainment without charge, Israel is the one that has taken the lead in this regard. But this act is being defeated through Palestinian hunger strikers like Hisham Abu Hawash, who was detained without charge or trial. He ended a 141-day hunger strike after reaching a deal with Israel to be released on February 26. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Israel continues this illegal act while the world stands idly by and watches it, along with other Israeli atrocities that continue in the occupied territories.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Charlotte Cates. She's an international coordinator at the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us, Mazen Kumsaya, Palestinian scientist and author, who joins us from Bethlehem.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and Mazen Kumsaya, let me first start with you. Administrative detention may be familiar to us, but maybe for some it's not. If you can please explain to us what it is that is causing this controversy, what is the definition of it, and why does Israel, in this case, employ execute it?
Well, first we congratulate the family of Hisham for finally having this agreement to release him and thus breaking his fast. He is one of many who are subjected to these cruel and unusual circumstances that are forbidden by international law. We have to remember that Israel is breaking records in these things. It's breaking records in having the longest held political prisoner, Nael Barghouti, over 41 years in prison so far. There's other people, stories that are really sad, like Nasser Abu Hamid, who has cancer, who's also fasting. He entered into a coma yesterday. He's been in prison since 2002. And he has four brothers who are in prison. Their home was destroyed over five times. Another cruel and unusual punishment that Israel engages in. There is Khalid Fasfus, who has entered into his 131st day of fasting, and his life is also threatened. So there are stories upon stories upon stories that one could tell, all in violation of international law, that Israel does its thing and gets away with it.
All right. Charlotte Cates, our guest there, and we appreciate Mazen Kumsaya for mentioning some of the other people who are actually in Israeli jails, and some who are on a hunger strike that are continuing with it. Why do you think Israel agreed to actually release this particular prisoner, given the fact that it could have opted not to? But Hisham Abu Hawash was able to get a deal with Israel and for Israel to then release him. And why is it that that is seen by many as a big success when it comes to Palestinians?
Well, administrative detention, I mean, which is the particular kind of imprisonment under which Hisham Abu Hawash was held, is a form of torture in many ways, including psychological torture, because of the fact that Palestinian prisoners held under administrative detention never know when they are going to be released, and neither do their families. They're not able to make plans for the future. They're not able to think about what they're going to be doing in the future because of the fact that Israel even refuses not only to charge them or to try them, but to even give them a date of release. The reason why Hisham Abu Hawash and, of course, many other hunger strikers in the past have been able to extract a victory from the occupation is because of their own steadfastness, their own resistance, their leadership in the Palestinian prisoners movement, which plays a leading role in the Palestinian liberation struggle, and, of course, the power and strength and commitment of the Palestinian resistance, which repeatedly expressed its commitment to see the liberation of Hisham Abu Hawash and to see the liberation of all Palestinian prisoners. And so Hisham's victory is not just a victory for himself, but one for the entire Palestinian National Liberation Movement, and really for all people who care about justice in the world. Right now, there is a boycott of the Israeli military courts that's being carried out by over 500 administrative detainees, and this gives that entire movement strength and further support to move forward and to win a victory against administrative detention.
What is this thing that you just mentioned about the court? If you can just elaborate for us briefly.
Sure. Well, on the 1st of January of this year, the administrative detainees, there are over 500 Palestinians held without charge or trial under indefinitely renewable administrative detention orders, which are put in place via a secret file. And they're among over 4,500 Palestinian political prisoners in total held within the Israeli occupation prisons. They announced on the 1st of this year that they were launching a full boycott of the Israeli military courts and higher courts because these courts are nothing more than a facade that presents the false image that there is some kind of legal process going on, when in reality there is nothing more than rubber stamping the arbitrary detention orders of the Israeli intelligence service, the Shin Bet.
Sure. And that's important. And if you can tell us, Mazen Kumsaya, why this boycott is important. Because from what I'm understanding, it takes away the legitimacy that Israel wants to portray, as our guest there said, if I'm correct to understand it that way.
Indeed. You know, Israel claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East when it is the worst offender of human rights in the world today in many, many aspects. It's an apartheid racist regime that has two sets of laws. One set of real laws for Jews and one set that's reserved for the what they consider inferior human beings. which are the native Palestinians, indigenous people. Our lives here are guided basically by the whims and whimsical interests of military commanders who obviously have only one interest in mind, which is the advancement of colonization on our land, which means more theft of land and more destruction of homes. That's basically the whole process of colonization, built on this idea of giving it a quasi-legal structure so that the world, you know, it's a public relations thing, so that the world says, well, there is Israeli courts and so on. But as pointed out by the other speaker, these are only rubber stamping, basically, whatever the military and the Israeli government decides to do to finish off and liquidate the Palestinian struggle.
Okay, let's get a little bit beyond the prisoner plight here, of which we have talked about somewhat briefly. And I'm looking, Charlotte Cates, at something that's very disturbing that I see every week, if not daily, but I see it every week. And I'm not too sure if the world is seeing it every week, but they should. And my point of reference here is a source by the name of Palestinian Center for Human Rights. And when I look at the weekly report that comes out in this particular website of the different violations that happen in the occupied territories, among the different ones, which is a long list, the one that I'm reading, December 23 through the 29th, the Israeli military had 101, in one week now, 101 incursions into the occupied West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. 60 Palestinians arrested, including 6 children. 1 week. Every week, more or less, along the same numbers, if not more, sometimes less. Why is this not being highlighted in order for the plight of people, for just this one particular reason, which is the illegal detainment? Why isn't that just being highlighted when it's happening on a weekly basis?
Well, in 2021 alone, over 8,000 Palestinians were arrested during the year. And of course, sometimes when we look at the number of prisoners, the number of arrests, we don't really see reflected in those figures. And this is especially true for child detainees, because of the fact that they might be held for several days. And during this time, they're subjected to solitary confinement, to military interrogations, to various forms of torture and abuse. And, you know, even if they are released afterwards, rather than being sent to a military court, the severe effects of that kind of mistreatment on Palestinian children continue to affect them for years and years to come. And so sometimes even when we talk about the fact that there are 200 Palestinian children right now locked in Israeli occupation prisons, it doesn't convey the full sense of the violence that's being committed against Palestinian children and against the Palestinian people as a whole. In Samidun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, and many organizations around the world are working hard to bring attention to this issue and to free all Palestinian prisoners, and of course to bring in Zionist colonialism throughout occupied Palestine from the river to the sea, because this is the only way to really bring an end to these kinds of ongoing violations and ongoing attacks. And there are many organizations that are involved in this effort. And so one of the most important things that people can do when they hear about this situation is to get involved with a group in your area, get involved with building the boycott of Israel, get involved in sharing this information on social media, because the imperialist powers that are allied with the Israeli occupation are not going to tell this story for us. Instead, it's very important that we tell this story ourselves and do everything we can in the streets to build power and give support to Palestinian prisoners who are leading in the resistance and the Palestinian people who are fighting back for liberation and return.
Sure. And this fight back came recently, something that was hailed across the Palestinian territories, Masih Mubsaya. And that was the breakout that happened, or a jailbreak that happened by the 6 Palestinians, which was described as a Hollywood-style escape from an Israeli prison. It was hailed as a big deal. And tell us why that is. And tell us whether that kind of sparked what we're seeing, acts of resistance, which is an increase, as we've now seen, with these Israeli hunger-striking prisoners.
Yes, and, you know, the breakout of an Israeli prison like that was a heroic act, and it's almost like a Hollywood-style movie. That they managed to escape from maximum security prison But I do want to add one thing to what was said about the prisoner situation. There are groups that try to defend prisoners, including Defense of Children International and groups that are prisoner rights groups. Israel is actually outlawing these groups, and they have outlawed 7 human rights groups just in the past 6 months. And those 7 human rights groups are considered by Israel to be quote-unquote terrorist groups. So even human rights groups and groups that defend prisoners are outlawed here, and effective resistance is being targeted in every aspect, regardless of the form of resistance. It's not just armed resistance, but any kind of resistance, any kind of nonviolent even resistance, any kind of demonstrations, any kind of even expression of opinions on Facebook and other media outlets are considered taboo and prevented here and are attacked here, and the people are punished for them. Israel has developed a system of repression that really is the envy of fascists and Nazis, for example. I think they have really created a system that's very, very strong and mean and powerful. But in opposition to that is, as we said, we are struggling and we engage in boycott and we engage in divestment, sanctions, and we are very proud of support of groups like and people like Desmond Tutu, who died recently, a friend of mine, and others. Really, we are very grateful for international mobilization, and the right will eventually win. I am very, very hopeful, and I'm very optimistic about this.
Well, the landscape as it stands, maybe you can tell us if you agree or not, Charlotte Cates, is it looks like Israel is penetrable. When you take a look at what happened with that prison break, when you take a look at how this hunger strike that was conducted, in which a deal was set and Israel agreed to release him, the topic of our program. When you take a look at the most recent Gaza war, where you had these rockets actually penetrate the so-called Israel's Iron Dome system, and also many reports coming out saying that the Israeli army, its soldiers, they're not really even prepared for a war. It kind of shows Israel in a weak state. Is that correct to look at Israel that way?
Because, you know, Israel has a lot of weaponry. It has a lot of technological power. It's given $3.8 billion a year by the United States, which, you know, there's been another $1 billion added to this. And this money goes straight to weaponry, right? And so you also have the unlimited political and diplomatic support given by not just the U.S., but other imperialist powers in Europe and Canada and elsewhere. But what you also have is the fundamental weakness of the imposition of a Zionist regime in the middle of this region as an imperialist outpost. And there's a fundamental illegitimacy to that project of Zionism within the region. And this is being rejected by the Arab people, by the people of the region, and certainly by the Palestinian people. And so when we see things like the victories of the Palestinian resistance, when we see things like the growing strength of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza and elsewhere, when we look at the 6 prisoners who escaped in this heroic, you know, action from Gilboa, one reason why this inspired Palestinians everywhere, inside Palestine and exile and diaspora, and also people struggling for justice in Palestine everywhere around the world, is because it exposed the cracks and flaws and weaknesses in this technological superiority that is enjoyed by the Israeli occupation state. And so all of this must actually inspire us to redouble our efforts to strengthen our work to build the boycott and isolation of Israel, because we know that it is possible for Israel to lose. We know that it is possible for the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people to win. And so this is the moment to escalate solidarity. This is the moment to escalate the isolation of Israeli apartheid immediately.
Okay, you talked about that very well. And Mazen Kumsaya, with the rejection of Israel and what it is doing, has been, since you mentioned Desmond Tutu, I'm making a comparison here, that the apartheid policies of the Israeli regime, the comparison is made there. And many have concluded, whether it's analysts, politicians even, that this is not going to last. You even have Hollywood rejecting Israel. I'm not going to name the Hollywood actress who recently displayed solidarity with the Palestinians, because I'll get faulted for mentioning her name in terms of any endorsement, which obviously I'm not going to do. But even there, where Israel is said to have a hold on Hollywood, it's being rejected. What will it take then for this regime to lose the right of doing what it's doing in the occupied territories?
I mean, oppressors do not easily give up. They do not easily hand over power. Oppressors have to be forced to hand over power. They have to be forced to do what is right. That's why it's essential to apply this pressure in all aspects of resistance, all aspects of boycott, divestments, media work. All of this is very, very critical. I think the biggest obstacle actually for us is not the power of the Israeli military might. The biggest obstacle for us is the collaborationist Arab regimes and even among the Palestinian leadership who think that Israel is invincible and that Israel is here to last forever, and you might as well just collaborate and have normalization with it like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and others have done. Those are much more of a danger to us than the military might of Israel or its support from the West. There was a lot of support and military might for South Africa under apartheid, and it crumbled because of public pressure. But the important thing, just like with South Africa, not to have too many Chief Buthelezi of South Africa, and not to have too many people here of the Palestinian leadership who meet with Israeli military leaders and wait okay. for the crumbs of the table to come down their way. This is a big obstacle for us. That's what we have to overcome.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. We're fresh out of time. Mazen Kamsaya there, Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. Charlotte Cates, thank you so much. International coordinator at the Summit and Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who spoke to us from Vancouver. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. For Mikko Vitahvay, it's goodbye. Until next time.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam dini wal-azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules related to prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Okay, Sheikh Sawid, since we are talking about the rules about prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei, let me ask this question first at the beginning of this episode. What are the conditions that require to be, in fact, fulfilled? These conditions have to be met or should be met, making sure that our prayers are valid. Do we have any kind of responsibility or are we duty-bound to make sure that our prayers become valid? And what are those conditions?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are at least 6 conditions which must be fulfilled in order for our prayers to be valid. When it comes to the clothes we wear, yes?
Yes.
The clothes we wear. One of the first conditions that must be fulfilled is that the clothes we wear must be pure. There should be no impurity, essential impurity, or secondary impurity on our clothes. It must be ritually pure. And the second condition, which is also very much important, is that it should be allowable. It should be mubah, and mubah means that it should not be gained from the money,
unlawfully or illicit,
illicitly. It should not have been usurped by the individual who offers his prayers. Otherwise, the prayer will be affected. And then the third condition is that the cloth he wears during prayer should not be made of the parts of a carcass or a dead animal or a dead animal. You know, for example, it should not be made of the skin or the hide of an animal which has not been slaughtered according to Islamic law. And this is the third condition. We are trying to be brief, okay? And then it should not be from the parts of an animal whose meat is essentially impure. For example, wolves, jackals, loins, and leopards,
rabbits,
And rabbits, of course, we have crocodiles, you know, which are very much used and for making shoes, clothes, and jackets, you know. The clothes we wear,
yes,
we wear, should not be made from any part of the animals whose meat is haram to eat. And number five, the clothes of a man who offers prayers should not be made of gold. There shouldn't be any gold ornaments, any jewelry or anything like that with the man while offering prayer. For example, if he has a gold ring or a gold watch or anything like that, or if maybe the buttons of his shirt are made of gold, then obviously his prayer, according to all religious authorities, not this ruling is not specific or particular to the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, his prayers will be white.
What about the fabric made of silk?
Yeah, the silk. That's the last condition, you know. The clothes worn by a man should not be made of pure silk.
Mm-hmm.
Pure silk, you know. So, silk-made clothes are haram for men to wear, whether a person is offering prayer or is not offering prayer. So, clothes made of silk are forbidden for men, not for women. The same is the case with gold. Gold is forbidden for men, and it's not forbidden for women.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the six conditions which must be fulfilled by the person who is offering prayer. And when it comes to his clothes only, you know, when it comes to the conditions of the prayer, of course, those are the separate things. You know,
yes.
The invalidating agents are there. How to offer the prayers and what are the requirements? What are the conditions that must be fulfilled or met while offering prayer? Those are different issues, you know, we are not going to discuss in this episode.
You included only gold for men as one of the jewelries, right? But
yes.
Not, for example, silver, because some cultures also use silver, for example, rings, as a kind of ornament, right? For men,
sure.
Obviously. But that is not the invalidator of the prayer.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't affect the prayer.
Yes.
Silver is permissible according to Islam.
Okay. What about platinum?
Platinum, of course, is allowed. It's permissible.
Because they also call it something
white
like
gold.
Gold. Yes, white gold.
No, platinum, according to...
It's not basically gold,
yeah,
right?
It's not gold, you know. Even Supreme Leader says that if you are wearing an ornament with a small quantity of gold, which is in common view, it's not considered to be gold.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we have something like called white gold, okay? White gold, if it is actually called gold in common view, then it's haram to wear it.
Mm-hmm.
The color is not important, you know, it can be white, but it still is considered to be gold.
Mm-hmm.
But if the amount of gold used is so little that it is considered to be as absent in the ornament that that a man wears, yes, it's kind of, let's say, negligible, you know.
Yes.
Then it is permissible and it does not affect the prayer.
What about gilded metal? The kind of metal which is covered or coated with a little bit thin layer of gold.
Yeah.
Does that make the prayers invalid for women?
Of course. Gold-plated items, you know, are haram to wear, you know. We know that
for men,
yeah,
yes.
Of course. We know that the watch is not, you know, watch is not something
like a wristwatch.
Yeah. So, but you know, the handles, you know, or maybe some parts of the watch might be gold plated. Even then, it's not permissible for a man to wear the wristwatch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Al-Ali al-Azim, Subhanallah. back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about the rules about prayers according to Ayatollah Khamenei, and we have Sheikh Javed still at the studio. Sheikh Javed, one of the conditions you said that need to be actually fulfilled in order to render the prayers valid, in fact, and you mentioned six of those conditions, right? And
sure.
One of them was the purity of the clothes, for example,
yes.
And the dress in which the individuals, in fact, offer the prayer in. If a person doubts
yeah.
whether their clothes are pure or impure, what becomes of them? Can they offer the prayers in those clothes?
Well, according to the general principle, the principle of Isala al-Tathir or Isala al-Tahara, of course, the principality of something, the principality of purity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the principle which is used by not only by the religious scholars, but also by ordinary duty-bound individuals. According to this principle, everyone should treat everything as pure unless and until he is 100% sure that that thing is impure.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do not know whether a certain dress that you are going to wear is pure or impure, it is your responsibility and it is your duty as a Muslim individual to treat it as pure. So therefore, even if it may in fact be impure,
mm-hmm.
but since you have no information, you don't know anything about it, you still can wear it, and the prayer that you offer will be valid.
Mm-hmm. I see. But, you know, sometimes it happens that people don't know whether their clothes are pure or impure, but later they find out that their prayers are their clothes are actually impure. In that case, Sheikh Javed, is the said prayer valid?
Because that person did not know that his clothes
mm-hmm.
was impure, and he offered his prayer thinking that the clothes is pure. But later on, he came to know that his clothes is not pure. According to all religious authorities, including Supreme Leader Grand mm-hmm. Ayatollah Khamenei, his prayer is valid in this assumption, in this case.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun man la ilaha illa hum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun samiun basir لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to, and with me in the studio are two experts, two Islamic scholars from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Ali Al-Abiyan and Said Mohsen Naghvi. This series of Viewpoints is concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Before anything, let's say salam to the experts over here. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and brother Alevian, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thanks for having me here.
You're welcome, brother. Okay, You know that 1 year have passed the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, who was killed in a drone attack by the U.S. last year. And for the commemoration ceremony of this dear general of Iran, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, tried to dedicate this series of the program to the speeches and thoughts of Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about General Soleimani. Brother Ali, this istikbar, you know, and its breakdown in the region by Qasem Soleimani and ISIS, which really they spend lots of money in the region, but a man like Soleimani with some, we can say, barricades from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran, Fatemiyun, Zainabiyun, okay, comes to the scene and stop all these, we can say, money expenditure over there in the region. ISIS, you know, we know they were rich. Very their true. Military, we can say, facilities were really high and modern. Very so true. What's your take on that, brother?
Yeah, on the continuation of actually enumerating the features of the school of thought of Soleimani, I think we shall get to that point as well. We wanted to mention some other features that the fourth that we want to focus on today is his purity of intention that was actually pointed in our conversation, and not being a person of pretension and hypocrisy. It is quite clear for Iranians, those who have sensed him in the country, that even after his martyrdom, people understood what a great person he was. You know, he did not let those cameramen to broadcast whatever have been recorded from it.
That's right.
So these scenes of, let's say, purity of this person to be in different battlefields, not only in the battlefield of war, I don't know, against ISIS, but even at the time that, for example, he was needed in the flood of Khuzestan province.
Yeah, the natural disaster.
Natural disasters in different parts. In the north of Iran, again, we had some flood issues.
Yeah.
So he was present there.
He was a social activist over there, that's
very
right.
True. Okay. So we see that this sort of activities seen from a general, high-ranking general, cannot be seen in different countries and, let's say, different nations.
This
I don't know.
It's very much different from the generals who are very, we can say, sharp and serious. You know,
very
the generals
true.
Usually the military ones are shown with the medals over the chest. Soleimani was not over there. Okay.
And the next feature of the school of thought of Soleimani was the spirituality, I can call it. Mm-hmm. What does this spirituality mean? Mm-hmm. Usually, colonels, generals, even if they are Muslims,
yes.
and specifically, let's say, the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, and the battlefield, based on some jurisprudential ahkam or, let's say, decrees based on some fiqh issues, in some special cases, they are free from doing, for example, some of their obligatory acts.
That's
in
right.
very special cases.
Yes.
But this person actually tuned himself to even to adhere all those obligatory and even recommended actions that was on him to be done in its right time. And
yes.
he, and parallel to that, he does his job actually exactly as it was required.
Right.
So this person was a man of tahajjud and salatul layl, the night prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, even in, I want to compare to others. Let's say, how many do we have, for example, from armed forces to be, for example, in that, let's say, state of,
yes.
Let's say, spirituality and obedience towards God, which was expected to be seen from, for example, a religious scholar.
Mm-hmm.
So this person, in the, let's say, poems that he was reciting.
Being a religious man inside a mosque is very easy.
Yeah,
but being a religious man inside a field of military action is really difficult.
Very
you know,
true.
And when you are safe, okay, being religious is really easy.
Yeah,
especially when you see your like men being killed by the enemies,
okay.
and you capture someone.
Yeah,
you need to obviously at that time everyone is angry, especially we have seen like in different wars.
Yeah.
They do oppress those people, and Islam stops like from oppressing anyone, even the captives. Mm-hmm. And Qasim Soleimani has these characteristics that he never oppressed anyone. He never
went beyond
the limits.
Yeah.
He was within his limits. And that's what obviously we need to learn from him. How to be, you know, for example, we see like some people, unfortunately, when they go home, the husbands, when they're very much angry, they beat their, for example, wives.
Wow.
We have this oppression, like these things, like why this thing is happening with the women. It's because the people are going beyond their limits.
That's right.
And he, in the battlefield, is... He remained in his...
Of course, we do not recommend beating the women inside the house, okay? This is not
it's
at all...
It's just an example,
okay. But the case is that... One more case I want to mention,
because it is related to our discussion that even Sayyid actually explained it. When he was sieged in Syria once, and he was obliged to stay, for example, in a house that was... And the people of the house were not there. He wrote a letter to the owner of the house that I prayed in your house, I think, two times.
Without your permission,
but it was, it was out of my will, let's say.
Right.
And he asked him, in case you are happy with it, please accept my apologies. In case you do not agree, please, this is my phone number. Please call me so that I compensate for the time that I have been here in your house.
I perform my prayers. In another footage, he is talking about halal and haram.
Yeah.
You know, talking about halal and haram, especially in a war operation, is very difficult. We know that in all the operations that were led by Qasim Soleimani, no innocent, ordinary men or women or children were killed. None of them. By the Iranian forces, okay? But on the vice versa, I mean by Daesh and the ISIS, so many people were killed. He says that the lives of the people that you are operating in this operation are like the amana in your hands.
Very true.
So this amana or trust, as long as it is your hand, you have to take care of that.
And this line, again, to remember the brothers and sisters who are listening, was taken from the teachings of Imam Khomeini while in the imposed eight-year war. Imam Khomeini, when we were under the missiles, Iraqi missiles, like the city, a city like Dasful, who received more than 1,600 missiles during the wartime. But Imam did not allow any of these army people to reply them back. He said, because... They don't care if they kill ordinary people, but we don't want to kill ordinary people in the war. So this, look, this, the root of this, let's say, tactic is taken from, as you rightly mentioned in previous show, from the leader from the Imam.
Yeah, the love of humanity.
America's drones, like, they kill many innocent people in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
They've killed many of the innocent people, and they don't care about these things. So this is what we need to... Obviously, there must be some criteria for the general people.
Yeah.
The people who are listening, they need to make some criteria to choose between right and wrong.
Sure.
And obviously, the school of Qasim Soleimani has unveiled the reality of the Americans who call themselves as to be the ones who have raised the human rights flag.
Right.
So this is also one of the threats.
And another beautiful thing which was said by, I do want to say that even in the opponent groups of the Islamic Republic of Iran outside, Qasim Soleimani was welcomed as a face who fought for an international integrity. This is very important. Because whenever they are criticizing Islamic Revolution of Iran or the policies inside, they say, okay, they are Muslims, they want to act as Islamic as possible and do not regard Iran. But Qasim Soleimani has shown that Iran and Islam both are important for him. This is very important, the weight that he gives to the Iranian people regardless of their language, of their color, of their race inside Iran. He was really... We can say the embodiment of Iran and the Iranian cultural values.
It's true that in case he was not in the battlefront, for example, in neighboring countries or in Lebanon or in Yemen or anywhere else in the world, the enemies were among us in the, let's say, western borders of our country, but it does not necessarily mean that he was helping them just because, just to save Iran. No. I think in Islam we don't have a geographical border. And even in his behavior, in if in pathological look in his behavior, it looks that he looked an Iranian exactly with the same eye that he was looking at Iraqi or Yemeni.
Yeah,
or
thank you much, Brother Ali Alevian and Thayed Mohsen Naqvi for presence in the program. Viewpoints, it was very kind of you, dear listeners. Thank you much for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Do not forget to visit our website, parstudio.com/Ian Color of Islam page, also YouTube page, Color of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
اصطفاك واجتباك للخلود في ثراك للقاك هل أعود أو وراك في سماك من جديد ذات يوم فيه قبري عند قبرك ويشم الناس روحانا بعطرك إن روحي الآن كم تشتاق وصلك قد تأخرت كثيرا توت بعدك من دماك لعلاك يا شهيد اصطفاك واجتباك للخلود في ثراك للقاك هلعود أو وراك في سماك من جديد يبقى باب أشلاء يزار أو بقايا من وصاياي الكثار بالشهادات أنت حققت انتصار وانتظرت أنا لألحق بالمسار من دماك لعلاك يا شهيد اصطفاك واجتباك للخلود في ثراك للقاك هل أعود وراك في سماك من جديد
يوسف جلالي بتهوان
روباشافت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American-Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need of unity among Muslims and called on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis, and all Muslims, because there has been so many cruel activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahl-e Bayt alayhi salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very